You guys stay here.
I crawled around the side of the house to the bluish TV glow. Anyone who came into the yard or passed beneath the black pines would have seen me. I stood and leaned slowly to the edge of the window. It was open, to catch the June breeze. I could see the back of Father Travis's head. He was sitting before the television in an easy chair, and at his elbow there was a city beer, a Michelob. I couldn't tell what he was watching at first, and then I realized it was a movie, not a television movie. I sank down and crept back.
He's got a VHS player. What's he watching? This time Cappy went to look, and after a little while he came back and said it was Alien,
which had played 2 hours south of our reservation, in which we'd only heard brain-bending stories of because we had no way down there, and besides, we were too young to get in. There were no rental places on the reservation yet.
He must own it,
I said, forgetting the open window.
Who owns a copy?
Owns it?
Shut up, you guys, whispered Cappy. He's got his screens in.
Angus leaned back against the foundation of the building and drew his legs up to his chest. We put our heads together and spoke low.
Could you see it very good?
I could see it fine. He's got a 30-inch. So that's how we finally saw Alien, standing at the window behind a young priest we suspected of an unspeakable crime. Father Travis even turned the sound up so we could hear the whole movie. When the credits started to roll, he switched it off, and we ducked down and crawled around to where the bedroom had to be. We were still in delicious shock. Angus lay down and poked his fist up from his stomach and jerked his legs. The light went on in the bathroom again, and there was a trickling noise. Then toothbrushing and gargling noises. Then the light went on in the bedroom. We edged along the foundation, slowly rose. There were curtains and rolled down shades, but there was a gap where the shade met the window. The curtains were transparent panels. We could see fine. We watched Father Travis take off his wizardly cassock and hang it up. He had big, hard, muscled shoulders and rock-like pecs. Crazed scars looped down the divided slabs of his stomach. He shed his boxers and stood butt naked, then turned around. His scars all connected in a powerful tangle around his penis and balls. His equipment was there, but obviously sewn back on, said Angus later.
Odd, telling Zack.
Everything down there was scar tissue. Ridged, slick, gray, purple. We panicked, scrambled away. The lights went out. We darted toward our bikes, but Father Travis was unbelievably swift, out the door, and with a sure bound he seized Angus. Cappy and I kept running. Come back here, you two, said Father Travis in an even voice that carried perfectly, or I'll rip off his head.
Angus yelped.
We slowed and looked back. He had Angus by the throat. He means it.
Say your Hail Mary, said the priest.
Hail Mary, Angus choked.
Silently, said Father Travis.
Angus's mouth began to move. Cappy and I turned and walked back. The night wind came in and the pines sighed around us. The flickering yard lamps that lighted the church parking lot didn't reach beneath the black trees. Father Travis walked Angus before him to the house. Behind us, he ordered Cappy to open the door, and once we were in, he threw a deadbolt and kicked a chair up to the door. As you know, there's no back way out, he said, so you might as well make yourselves comfortable. He flung Angus at the couch, and we jumped forward and sat down on either side of Angus, hands folded in our laps. Father Travis pulled a plaid shirt on and grabbed his easy chair. He turned it to face us. And he sat down. He was wearing the boxers and the plaid shirt hung open. His chest was massive. I noticed a set of free weights on the floor and barbells in the corner. "Long time no see," he said to me and Angus. We were petrified. "Got an eyeful, huh? You dumb monkeys. What do you think?" He kicked me in the shin. And although he was barefoot, my leg went numb and I rocked backwards. "Say something." But we couldn't. "Okay, Dogface," he said to Cappy, "you tell me why you're spying on me. I know these two, but I don't know you. What's your name?" "John Pole's leg." A jolt of admiration shot straight through me. That Cappy could give a fake name at this moment? "Pole's leg? What kind of freaking name is that?" "It's an old traditional name, sir." "Sir? Where'd you get that, sir?" "My father was a Marine, sir." "Well, then you've disgraced him, you puling asswipe shit. Son of a Marine spying on a priest? What's your dad's name?" "Same name, sir." "So you're Pull's Leg Jr.?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, Pull's Leg Jr., how's this?" Father Travis reached out and yanked Cappy off the couch with one streaming jerk of his leg. Cappy hit the floor hard, but didn't cry out. "Pull's leg, huh? Is that how you got your dumb shit name?" He loomed down, and Cappy put his dukes up, but the priest just reached down and threw Cappy back on the couch. "All right, Pull's leg, Junior. What's your real traditional old-time name?" "Cappy LaFournay." "Doe's your father?"
"Yeah."
"Good man." He pointed a thick finger at Angus. "And I know who your aunt is." He stuck his finger in my face next. I couldn't breathe. "I know your dad, and I think I know why you pathetic scumbutts are here, spying on me. You. I started thinking about your question earlier this evening. Why you would ask me what I was doing on Sunday, May 15th, at such and such a time. Like you were asking for my alibi. I thought it was funny. Then I remembered what happened to your mom, and bingo. Our knees, our feet, our shoes had taken on a profound significance. We were studying them closely. We could feel his hammered silver eyes on us. "So you think I hurt your ma?" he said softly. "Well, answer." He kicked me again. The numbness turned to pain. "Yeah? No, I thought maybe." "Maybe?" Then the answer came in a flash, so to speak. "Huh?"
"Impossible. So you know. And just for your information, you little rat pukes, you cat farts, you jerk-off freaks, I wouldn't use my dick that way even if I still could. You yellow shit horn dogs, I have a mother, and I have a sister. I also had a girlfriend."
Father Travis leaned back. I glanced up at him. He was watching us from under his brow, his hands folded in his lap. His eyes had taken on that cyborg gleam. His cheekbones looked like they were going to break right through his skin. Not only did he own a copy of Alien, not only did he have an amazing and terrible wound, but he had called us humiliating names without actually resorting to the usual swear words. Besides, that was the deft speed with which he'd caught Angus. The free weights beside the television, the fancy Michelob, it was almost enough to make a boy want to be a Catholic.
"You had a girlfriend?"
Father Travis's face tightened to bone white. I could not believe Cappy's nerve. For a moment, I thought he was dead. But Cappy hadn't asked it in a taunting or sarcastic way at all. That was the thing about Cappy. He really wanted to know. He asked the question the way I know now a good lawyer might interview a potential witness, to find out about the other person, to hear his story. Father Travis didn't speak for a time, but Cappy maintained a silent willingness to listen. "Yes," said Father Travis at last. His voice was thicker now and low. "You skinny creamers don't know about women yet. You may think you do, but you don't. I was engaged to a real one, extremely beautiful, faithful, never faltered, not even when I got hit. She would have stayed. I was the one who...
Do you boys like girls?
I do, said Cappy, the only one who dared answer. Don't waste your time on sluts, said Father Travis. You in high school?
Going into high school, Cappy said.
All the better. There's a beautiful girl nobody else has noticed. You be the one to notice her.
All right, said Cappy.
So said Father Travis. So. He spread his hands over the arms of the chair. He watched us in silence until finally we raised our eyes to meet his lock-in stare.
You want to know how it happened? You want to know how I deal with it? You want to know things that you have no right to know?
But you're not bad boys. I can see that now. You wanted to find out who hurt your mother, his mother.
He stared at me.
I was at the U.S. Embassy in 83 and got lucky. I'm here, right? The spigot works. I have to take extremely good care of it, otherwise infections, some sex drive, all sublimated. I was in seminary school before becoming a Marine. Had a spell of anger. Came home like this, a sign. Finished up, ordained, shipped here. Any questions? I told him no priest here had ever shot the gophers.
Sisters gas them. You like to be gassed in a tunnel? Better thing to die clean outside.
They die like that.
He snapped his fingers. Turn over and look at the sky, huh? The clouds.
He wasn't looking at us. He wasn't looking at anything now. He waved his hand, dismissing us. We half rose. He was far away. He steepled his hands together and lowered his forehead to rest against his fingers. We edged past him to the door, quietly moved the chair, and undid the deadbolt. We shut the door carefully, and we walked over to our bikes. The wind was blowing harder now, beating the hood of the yard light so it flickered. The pines groaned, but the air was warm. A south wind brought by Shawana Benishi, the southern thunderbird, a rain-bearing wind.
Chapter 6, Daedalore.
The wind passed over us in a rolling mass of clouds that just kept moving until the sky went clear. Just like that, as if nothing had happened between us, my father and I began to talk. He told me he'd had an interesting conversation with Father Travis, and I froze up. But it was all about Texas and the military. Father Travis hadn't ratted on us. Whatever suspicions my father had expressed that night to Edward were gone, or submerged. I asked my father if he'd talked to Soren Bjerke.
The gas can? I asked.
Pertinent. Now that Father Travis was off the list, I'd been thinking about the cases and bench notes my father and I had pulled. I asked my father if Bjerke had questioned the Larks, brother and sister.
He's talked to Linda.
My father tensely frowned. He had promised himself not to involve me or confide in me or collaborate with me. He knew where it went, what I might get into, but he didn't know the half of it. And here was the thing I didn't understand then but do now. The loneliness. I was right in that there was just the three of us, or the two of us. Nobody else. Not Clements. Not even my mother herself cared as much as we did about my mother. Nobody else thought night and day of her. Nobody else knew what was happening to her. Nobody else was as desperate as the two of us. My father and I, to get our life back, to return to the before. So he had no choice, not really. Eventually, he had to talk to me.
I should visit Linda Wishkov, he said.
She stonewalled Bjerke.
But maybe. You want to come?
Linda Wishkov was magnetically ugly. Her pasty wedge of a face just cleared the post office counter. She regarded us with moon calf, bulging eyes, Her wet red lips were curls of flesh. Her hair, a cap of straight brown floss, quivered as she pulled out commemoratives. She displayed them for my father. She reminded me of a pop-eyed porcupine, even down to her fat little long-nailed paws. My father chose a set of 50 states of the Union and asked if he could buy her a cup of coffee.
"There's coffee in back here," said Linda. "I can drink it free."
She regarded my father warily. Although she knew my mother, everyone knew what had happened, but nobody knew what to say or what not to say.
"Never mind about the coffee," said my father. "I'd like to have a word with you. Why don't you get someone to cover for you? You aren't busy."
Linda opened her wet lips to protest, but could not think of a good excuse. In a few moments, she had cleared things with her supervisor and came from around the counter. We walked out of the post office and across the street to Mighty L's, which was a little soup can of a place. I couldn't believe my father was going to question someone in close quarters of Mighty's, which had six scrounge tables crammed together. And I was right. My father asked no questions of Linda, but proceeded to have a useless conversation about the weather.
My father could outweather anybody.
Like people anywhere, there were times when it was the only topic where people here felt comfortably expressive, and my father could go on earnestly, seemingly forever. When the current weather was exhausted, there was all the weather that had occurred in recorded history, whether lived through or witnessed by a relative, or even heard about on the news. Catastrophic weather of all types. And when that was done with, there was all the weather that might possibly occur in the future. I even heard him speculate about weather in the afterlife. Dad and Linda Wishkob talked about the weather for quite a while, and then she got up and left.
"You really put her through the ringer, Dad."
The blackboard menu today advertised hamburger soup. All you could eat. We started on our second bowls of steaming hot soup, ground meat, commodity macaroni, canned tomatoes, celery, onion, salt, and pepper. It was especially good that day. Dad had also ordered Mighty's coffee, which he called the Stoic's Choice. It was always burnt. He kept drinking it expressionlessly after we'd finished the soup. "I wanted to get a feel for how she was doing," said my father. "She's been through the ringer enough, for real." I wasn't sure what coming down to talk with Linda Wishkob was about, but apparently some exchange I didn't understand took place. Dad had finally allowed Cappy to come over that day. It was a grueling hot afternoon, so we were inside playing Bionic Commando, quietly as we could, with the fan on. As always, my mother was sleeping. There was a soft tap. I answered the door, and there was Linda Wishkob, her bulging eyes, her tight blue uniform, her sweaty, dull, makeupless face. Those long fingernails on the stubby fingers suddenly struck me as sinister, though they were painted an innocent pink.
"I'll just wait for her to wake up," said Linda.
She surprised me by stepping past me into the living room. She nodded at Cappy and sat down behind us. Cappy shrugged, and as we hadn't played our game for a while and were not going to quit for any small reason, we continued. For years, our people have struggled to resist an unstoppable array of greedy and unstable beings. Our army has been reduced to a few desperate warriors, and we are all but weaponless and starving. We taste the nearness of defeat. But deep in the bowels of our community, our scientists have perfected an unprecedented fighting weapon. Our bionic arm reaches, crushes, flexes, faints, folds. It pierces armor, and its heat-seeking sensors can detect the most well-defended foe. That bionic arm combines the power of an entire army in itself and must be operated by one and only one soldier who can meet the test. I am that soldier. Or Cappy is that soldier. The Bionic Commando? Our mission takes us through the land of 1,000 eyes, where death awaits us around every corner and through every window. Our destination, enemy headquarters, the heart of our hated foe's impregnable fortress. The challenge, impossible. Our resolve, unflagging. Our courage, quitless. Our audience, Linda Wishkob. She watched us in such utter silence that we forgot about her. She hardly breathed or moved a muscle. When my mother left her room and went to the upstairs bathroom, I didn't hear that either, but Linda did. She padded to the foot of the stairs, and before I could say or do anything, she called my mother's name. Then she started walking up the stairs. I quit playing and jumped up, but already Linda's soft, round body was at the top of the stairs, and she was greeting my mother as if my mother weren't skinnily tottering away from her. Disoriented, discovered, and invaded. Linda Wishkob did not seem to notice my mother's agitation. With a kind of oblivious simplicity, she just followed her into her room. The door remained open. I heard the bed creak, the scrape of Linda's chair, and then their voices as they started to talk. A few days later, there was finally a steady downpour of rain, and I stayed inside for the second time that summer, playing my games, drawing cartoons. Angus had been working on his second portrait of Worf, but Star had called up and told him to borrow a plumber's snake from Cappy's place. They were over at Angus's now, probably drinking Elwyn's blats and pulling goop out of a stinking drain. My pictures bored me. I thought of sneaking the Cohen handbook, but reading my father's cases and notes had set up a despair in me. On a day like this, I might have gone upstairs, locked myself in my room, and paged through my hidden homework folder. My mother's presence upstairs had killed that habit off. I was thinking of slogging over to Angus's, or even of taking out the third and fourth token books my father had got me for Christmas, but I wasn't sure I was desperate enough to do either thing. The rain was that endless, gray, pounding kind of rain that makes your house feel cold and sad even if your mother's spirit isn't dying right upstairs. I thought it might wash all the plants out of the garden, but of course that wouldn't worry my mother. I took her a sandwich, but she was asleep. I took out the token set. I had just started reading as the rain came down and down, when out of the drumming pour, like a drenched hobbit, Linda Wishkob arrived again to visit. Upstairs she went, with hardly a look at me. She had a little package in her hands, probably some of her banana bread. She bought black bananas and was known for her bread. A whole lot of murmuring went on upstairs. So mysterious to me. Why my mother chose to speak to Linda Wishkob might have bothered me, or set me on alert, or at least made me wonder. I didn't, but my father did. When he came home and learned that Linda was upstairs, he said to me in a soft voice, "Let's trap her." "What?" "You be the bait." "Oh, thanks. She'll talk to you, Joe. She likes you. She likes your mother, me. She's wary of. Listen to them upstairs." "Why do you want her to talk?" "We need every piece of information. We need to know what she can tell us about the Larks." "But she's a Wishkob. Adopted, remember? Remember the case, Joe, the case we pulled?" "I don't think it's relevant." "Nice word." But finally, I agreed to do it, and Dad had fortunately brought some ice cream. It was Linda's favorite food. Even on a rainy day, he smiled. She's cold-blooded. So when Linda came down the stairs, I asked if she wanted a bowl of ice cream. She asked what flavor. I told her we had the stripe stuff, Neapolitan, she said, and accepted a bowl. We sat down in the kitchen, and Dad casually closed the door, saying that Mom needed her rest, and how good it was of Linda to visit, and how much everyone had enjoyed her banana bread.
The spice is excellent, I said.
I only use cinnamon, said Linda, and her pop eyes swelled with pleasure.
Real cinnamon. I buy in jars, not cans. From a foreign food section down in Hornbacher's, Bargo. Not the stuff you get here. Sometimes I use a little lemon zest or orange peel.
She was so happy we liked the banana bread that I thought maybe Dad wouldn't need me to get her to talk, but he said, wasn't it good, Joe?
And then I said how I'd eaten it for breakfast and how I'd even stolen a piece because Mom and Dad were hogging it all.
I'll bring two loaves next time, Linda said lovingly.
I spooned ice cream into my mouth and tried to let my father draw her out, but he raised his eyebrows at me.
Linda, I said, I heard. You know, I wonder. I guess I'm asking a personal question.
Go right ahead, she said, and her pale features went rosy. Maybe nobody asked her personal questions, I thought quickly and let my tongue fly.
I have friends, you know, whose parents or cousins were adopted out of the tribe, and that is hard.
Well, I've heard that, but I guess nobody ever talks about getting adopted in.
Linda showed her little rat teeth in such a simple, encouraging smile that I was reassured now and suddenly found I really wanted to know. I wanted to know her story.
I ate more ice cream. I said I really did like the banana bread, and that I was surprised I had, because the truth was usually I hated banana bread. What I mean is suddenly I forgot my father and really started talking to Linda.
I went past Popeyes and sinister porcupine hands and wispy hair and just saw Linda and wanted to know about her, which is probably why she told me.
Linda's story. I was born in the winter, she started, but then she stopped to finish her ice cream. Once she pushed away the bowl, she started for real. My brother was born 2 minutes before me. The nurse had just wrapped him in a blue flannel warming blanket when the mother said, "Oh, God, there's another one." And out I slid, half dead. I then proceeded to die in earnest. I went from slightly pink to dull gray-blue, at which point the nurse tried to scoop me into a bed warmed by lights. The nurse was stopped by the doctor, who pointed out my crumpled head, arm, and leg. Stepping in front of the nurse and me, the doctor addressed the mother, telling her that the second baby had a congenital deformity, and asking if she should use extraordinary means to salvage it. The answer was no. No, let it die. But while the doctor's back was turned, the nurse cleared my mouth with her finger, shook me upside down, and swaddled me tight in another blanket, pink. I took a blazing breath. "Nurse," said the doctor. "Too late," she answered. I was left in the nursery with a bottle strapped onto my face while the county decided how I would be transported to some sort of transitional situation. I was still too young to be admitted to any state-run institution, and Mr. and Mrs. George Lark refused to have me in their house. The night janitor at the hospital, a reservation woman named Betty Wishkob, asked permission to hold me on her break. While cradling me, with her back turned toward the observation window, Betty, Mom, nursed me. As she fed me, Mom molded and rounded my head in her powerful hand. Nobody in the hospital knew that she was nursing me at night, or that she was doctoring me and had decided to keep me. This was 5 decades ago. I'm 50 now. When Mom asked if she could take me home, there was relief, and not a lot of paperwork involved, at least in the beginning. So I was saved and grew up with the Wishkobs. I lived on the reservation and went to school as an Indian person would, first at the mission and later at the government school. But before then, around the age of 3, I was taken away for the first time. I still remember the smell of disinfectant and what I call white despair, into which there came a presence, someone or something who grieved with me and held my hand. That presence stayed with me. The next time a welfare officer decided to find a more suitable home for me, I was 4, I stood beside Mom, holding her skirt, green cotton. I hid my face in the scent of heated cloth. Then I was in the back seat of a car that sped soundlessly in some infinite direction. I woke alone in another white room. My bed was narrow, and the sheets were tucked tightly down, so I had to struggle to get out. I sat on the edge of the bed for what seemed like a long time, waiting. When you are little, you do not know that you are screaming or crying. Your feelings and the sound that comes out of you is all one thing. I remember that I opened my mouth, that is all, and that I did not shut it until I was back with Mom. Every morning, until I was about 11 years old, Mom and my dad, Albert, tried to round my head and work my arms and legs. They made me lift a little bag filled with sand that Mom sewed into a weight. They woke me first and brought me into the kitchen. The wood stove was going, and I drank a glass of thin blue milk. Then Mom sat in one kitchen chair and put me in her lap. She rubbed my head and cupped her powerful fingers and pulled my skull into shape. "You're going to see things sometimes," Mom told me once. "Your soft spot stayed open longer than most babies. That's how spirits get in." Dad sat across from us in another chair, ready to stretch me from head to toe. "Put your feet out, Tuffy," he said. That was my nickname. I put my feet in Dad's hands, and he pulled me one way while Mom held tight around my ears and pulled the other. My brother Cedric had given me the name Tuffy because he knew once I went to school I would get a nickname anyway. He didn't want it to refer to my arm or head, but my head, so misshapen when I was born that the doctor had diagnosed me for an idiot, was changed by Mom's squeezing and kneading. By the time I was old enough to look in a mirror, I thought I looked beautiful. Neither Mom nor Dad ever told me I was wrong. It was Cheryl who gave me the news, saying, "You are so ugly, you're cute." I looked in the mirror the next chance I got and noticed that Cheryl was telling the truth. The house we lived in still has a faint smell of rotted wood, onions, fried coot, the salty smell of unwashed children. Mom was always trying to keep us clean, and Dad was getting us dirty. He took us into the woods and showed us how to spot a rabbit, run, and set a snare. We yanked gophers from their holes with loops of string and picked pail after pail of berries. We rode a mean little bucking pony, fished perch from a nearby lake, dug potatoes every year for school money. Mom's job had not lasted. Dad sold firewood, corn, squash. But we never went hungry, and there was affection in our house. I knew I was loved because it was complicated for Mom and Dad to get me from the welfare system, though I'd helped out their efforts with my endless scream, all of which is not to say they were perfect. Dad drank from time to time and passed out on the floor. Mom's temper was explosive. She never hit, but she yelled and raved. Worse, she could say awful things. Once, Cheryl was twirling around in the house. There was a shelf set snugly in the corner. It held a cut glass vase that was very precious to Mom. When we brought her wildflower bouquets, she would put them in that vase. I had seen her washing the vase with soap and polishing it with an old pillowcase. Then Cheryl's arm knocked the vase off the shelf, and it struck the floor with a bright sound and shattered into splinters. Mom had been working at the stove. She whirled around, threw her hands out. "Damn you, Cheryl," she said. "That was the only beautiful thing I ever had." "Tuffy broke it," said Cheryl, bolting out the door. Mom began to cry harshly and put her forearm to her face and cheek. I moved to sweep up the pieces for her, but she said to leave them in such a hard, sick voice that I went to find Cheryl, who was hiding in her usual place on the far side of the henhouse. When I asked why she blamed me, Cheryl gave a hateful look and said, "Because you're white." I didn't hold anything Cheryl did then against her, and we became close later on. I was very glad for that, as I had never married, and needed to confide in someone when, 5 years ago, I was contacted by my birth mother. I lived in an addition tacked on to the tiny house until my parents died. They went one right after the other, as the long married sometimes do. It happened in a few months. By then, my brothers and sister had either moved off the reservation or built new houses closer to town. I stayed on, in the quiet. One difference was I let the dog, a descendant of one that growled at the welfare lady, live inside with me. Mom and Dad had stationed the television in the kitchen. They had watched it after dinner, bolt upright on their kitchen chairs, hands folded on the table surface. But I prefer my couch. I've had a fireplace installed with a glass front and fans that throw the heat off into a cozy circle. And there I sit every winter night, with the dog at my feet, reading or crocheting while I listen to the TV muttering for company. One night the telephone rang. I answered it with a simple hello. There was a pause. A woman asked if this was Linda Wishkopf speaking. "It is," I said. I experienced a strange skip of apprehension. I knew that something was about to happen. "This is your mother, Grace Lark." The voice was tight and nervous. I set the phone back down in the cradle. Later, that moment struck me as very funny. I had instinctively rejected my mother, left her in the cradle the way she left me in mine. As you know, I am a government employee. At any time, I could have found out the address of my birth parents. I could have called them up, or, hey, I could have gotten drunk and stood in their yard raving. But I didn't want to know anything about them. Why would I? Everything I did know hurt. And I have always avoided pain, which is maybe why I never married or had children. I don't mind being alone except for, well, that night. After I had hung up the phone, I made a cup of tea and busied myself with solving word puzzles. One stumped me. The clue was doubled goer, 12 spaces, and it took me the longest time in a dictionary to come up with the word doppelganger. I had always identified the visitations of my presence as one of those spirits Betty's doctoring led into my head. It first came when I was taken from Betty for that brief time and put into the white room. At other times, I had the sensation that there was someone walking beside me or sitting behind me, always just beyond the periphery of my vision. One of the reasons I let the dog live inside was that it kept away this presence, which over the years had grown to seem anxious, needy, helpless in some way I could not define. I had never before thought of the presence in relation to my twin, who'd grown up not an hour's drive away. But that night, the combination of the call, out of the blue, and the 12-letter word in my puzzle set my thoughts flowing. Betty told me she had no idea what the Larks had named the baby boy, though she probably knew. Of course, as we were different genders, we were fraternal twins and supposedly no more alike than any brother and sister. That night, my birth mother called. I decided to hate and resent my twin. I've heard her voice for the first time, shaky on the phone. He'd heard it all of his life. I had always thought I hated my birth mother, too, but the woman had called herself simply Mother. My brain had perfectly taped the words she said. All that night, and the next morning, too, they played on a loop. By the end of the second day, however, the intonation grew fainter. I was relieved that on the third day they stopped. Then on the fourth day, the woman called again. She began by apologizing. "I am sorry to bother you." She went on to say that she had always wanted to meet me and been afraid to find out where I was. She said that George, my father, was dead, and she lived alone, and that my twin brother was a former postal worker who had moved down to Pierre, South Dakota. I asked his name. Lyndon. It was an old family name. Was mine an old family name as well, I asked.
No, said Grace Lark. It just matched your brother's name.
She told me that George had quickly written my name down on the birth certificate and that they had never seen me. She went on talking about how George died of a heart attack and she had nearly moved down to Pierre to be near Lyndon, but she couldn't sell her home. She told me she hadn't known that I lived so close, or she would have called me long before. The light, conversational chatter must have caused a dreamlike amnesia to come over my mind, because when Grace Lark asked if we could meet, if she could take me out to dinner at Vert's Supper Club, I said yes and agreed on a day. When I finally hung up the phone, I stared for a long time at the little log fire set going in the fireplace. Before the call, I laid the fire and looked forward to popping some corn. I would throw kernels high in the air, and the dog would catch them. Perhaps I'd sit in the kitchen and watch a movie at the table, or maybe I'd stay by the fire and read my novel from the library. The dog would snore and twitch in his dreams. Those had been my choices. Now I was gripped by something else. A dreadful array of feelings yawned. Which should I elect to overcome me first? I could not decide. The dog came and put his head in my lap, and we sat there until I realized that one of the reactions I could have was numbness. Relieved, feeling nothing, I put the dog out, let him in, and went to bed.
So we met. She was so ordinary. I was sure that I'd seen her in the street, or at the grocery, or the bank, perhaps. It would have been hard to have missed seeing anyone, sometime, in a person's life around here. But she would not have registered as my mother because I could detect nothing familiar or like myself about her. We did not touch hands or certainly hug. We sat down across from each other in a leatherette booth. My birth mother stared at me. You aren't. Her voice fell off. Retarded? She composed herself. You got your coloring from your father, she said. George had dark hair. Grace Lark had red-rimmed blue eyes behind pale eyeglasses, a sharp nose, a tiny, lipless bow of a mouth. Her hair was typical for a woman of 77, tightly permed, gray-white. She wore stained dentures, big earrings made of cultured pearls, a pale blue pantsuit, and square-toed lace-up therapy shoes. There wasn't anything about her that called to me. She was just any other little old lady you wouldn't want to approach. I've noticed people on the reservation don't go toward women of her sort. I can't say why. A mutual instinct for avoidance, I guess. Would you like to order? Grace Lark asked, touching the menu. Have anything you like. It's all on me. No, thank you. We will split the check, I answered. I had thought about this in advance and concluded that if my birth mother wanted to assuage her guilt in some way, taking me out to dinner was far too cheap. So we ordered and drank our glasses of sour white wine. We got through the dinner of walleye and pilaf. Tears came into Grace Lark's eyes over a bowl of maple ice cream. I wish I'd known you were going to be so normal. I wish I hadn't ever given you up, she wept. I was alarmed at the effect that these words had on her and quickly asked, How's Lyndon? Her tears dried up. He's very sick, she said. Her face became sharp and direct. He's got kidney failure and is on dialysis. He's waiting for a kidney. I'd give him one of mine, but I'm a bad match and my kidney is old. George is dead. You are your brother's only hope. I put my napkin to my lips and felt myself floating up, off the chair, almost into space. Someone floated with me, just barely perceptible, and I could feel its anxious breathing. Now is the time to call Cheryl, I thought. I should have called her before. I had a $20 bill with me, and when I landed, I put that money on the table and walked out the door. I got to my car, but before I could get in, I had to run to the scarp of grass and weed that surrounded the parking lot. I was throwing up, heaving and crying, when I felt Grace Lark's hand stroking my back. It was the first time my birth mother had ever touched me, and although I quieted it beneath her hand, I could detect a stupid triumph in her murmuring voice. She'd known where I'd lived all along, of course. I pushed her away, repelled with hate like an animal sprung from a trap. Cheryl was all business. I'm calling Cedric down in South Dakota. Listen here, Tuffy. I'll get Cedric to pull the plug on this Linden, and you can forget this crap. That's Cheryl. Who else could make me laugh under the circumstances? I was still in bed the next morning. I'd call in sick for the first time in 2 years. You're not seriously even considering it, Cheryl said. Then after I didn't answer, are you? I don't know. Then I really am calling Cedric up. Those people ditched you. They turned their backs on you. They would have left you in the street to die. You're my sister. I don't want you to share your kidneys. Hey, what if I need one of your kidneys someday? Did you ever think of that? Save your damn kidney for me. I love you, Cheryl said, and I said it back. Tuffy, don't do it, Cheryl warned, but her voice was worried. After we hung up, I called the numbers on the card Grace Lark had put in my pocket and made hospital appointments for all the tests. While down in South Dakota, I stayed with Cedric, who was a veteran, and his wife, whose name is Cheryl with a C. She put out little towels for me that she had appliqued with the figures of cute animals, and tiny motel soap she'd swiped. She made my bed. She tried to show me that she approved of what I was doing, although the others in the family did not. Cheryl was very Christian, so it made sense. But this was not a do-unto-others sort of thing with me. I already said that I do not seek pain, and I would not have contemplated going through with it unless I could bear the alternative. All my life, knowing without knowing, I had waited for this thing to happen. My twin was the one just out of sight, right beside me. He did not know he had been there, I was sure. When the welfare stole me from Betty, and I was alone in the whiteness, he held my hand, sat with me, and grieved. And now that I've met his mother, I understood something more. In a small town, people knew, after all, what she had done in abandoning me. She would have to have turned her fury at herself, her shame, on someone else, the child she'd chosen. She'd have blamed Linden, transferred her warped hatreds to him. I had felt the contempt and triumph in her touch. I was thankful for the way things had turned out. Before we were born, my twin had the compassion to crush against me, to perfect me by deforming me, so that I would be the one who was spared. I'll tell you what, said the doctor, an Iranian woman, who gave me the results of the tests and conducted the interview. You are a match, but I know your story. And so I think it's only fair that you know Linden Lark's kidney failure is his own fault. He had not one but two restraining orders taken out against him. He also tried to suicide with a massive dose of acetaminophen, aspirin, and alcohol. That's why he's on dialysis. I think you should take that into account when making your decision. Later that day, I sat with my twin brother, who said, "You don't have to do this. You don't have to be a Jesus." "I know what you did," I told him. "I'm not religious." "Interesting," said Linden. He stared at me and said, we sure don't look alike. I understood this was not a compliment, because he was nice-looking. I thought he'd got the best of his mother's features, but the deceitful eyes and sharky mouth, too. His eyes shifted around the room. He kept biting his lip, whistling, rolling his blanket between his fingers. "Are you a mail carrier?" he asked. "I work behind the counter, mostly." "I had a good route," he said, yawning, "a regular route. I could do it in my sleep. Every Christmas, my people left me cards, money, cookies, that sort of thing. I knew their lives so well, their habits, every detail. I could have committed the perfect murder, you know." That took me aback. I did not answer. Lark pursed his lips and looked down. "Are you married?" I asked. "No, but maybe a girlfriend." He said this like, poor me, self-pity. He said, "My girlfriend's been avoiding me lately because a certain highly placed government official has started paying her to be with him, offering compensation for her favors. You get my drift?" I went speechless again. Lyndon told me that the girl he liked was young, working with the governor, that she got good grades and stood out, a model high school sweetheart picked to intern, an Indian intern making the administration look good, he said, and I even helped her get the job. She's really too young for me. I was waiting for her to grow up, but this highly placed official grew her up while I was stuck in the hospital. He's been growing her up ever since. I was uncomfortable and blurted out something to change the subject. "Did you ever think," I said, "there was someone walking your route just beside you or just behind you? Someone there when you closed your eyes? Gone when you opened them?" "No," he said. "Are you crazy?" That was me. I picked up his hand and he let it go limp. We sat there together, silent. After a while, he pulled his hand out of mine and massaged it, as though my grip had hurt him. "Nothing against you," he said. "This was my mother's idea. I don't want your kidney. I have an aversion to ugly people. I don't want a piece of you inside me. I'd rather get on a list. Frankly, you're kind of a disgusting woman. I mean, I'm sorry, but you've probably heard this before." "I might not be a raving beauty queen," I said, "but nobody's ever told me I'm disgusting." "You probably have a cat," he said. "Cats pretend to love whoever feeds them. I doubt you could get a husband or whatever, unless you put a bag on your head. And even then, it would have come off at night. Oh dear, I'm sorry." He put his finger on his mouth and looked slyly guilty. He gave his face a mock slap. "Why do I say these things? Did I hurt your feelings?" "Did you say those things to drive me away?" I asked. I had begun to float around again, the way I had in the restaurant. "Maybe you want to die. You don't want to be saved, right? I'm not saving you for any reason. You won't owe me anything." "Owe you?" He seemed genuinely surprised. His teeth were so straight that I was sure he'd had orthodontic work done when he was young. He started laughing, showing all those beautiful teeth. He shook his head, wagged his finger at me, laughing so hard he seemed to overcome. When I bent down awkwardly to pick up my purse, he laughed so hard he nearly choked. I tried to get away from him, to get to the door, but instead I backed up against the wall and was stuck there in that white, white room. My father sat silently at the table, hands folded and head lowered. I couldn't think of what to say at first, but then the silence went on so long, I said the first thing that came into my head. "Lots of pretty women own cats. Sonia? I mean, the cats live out in the barn, but she feeds them. You don't even have a cat. You have a dog. They are picky. Look at Pearl." Linda beamed at my father and said that he had raised a gentleman. He thanked her, and then said he had a question for her.
"Why did you do it?" he asked.
"She wanted it," said Linda. "Mrs. Lark, the mother, by the time the whole procedure was settled, I abhorred Lyndon. That's the word, abhorred. But he cozied up to me. Plus, it was ridiculous, because now I felt guilty about hating him. I mean, on the surface, he was not all bad. He gave to charity, cases, and sometimes he decided on a whim, I guess, that I needed his charity. Then he gave me presents, flowers, fancy scarves, soaps, sentimental cards. He told me how sorry he was when he was mean. Temporarily charmed me, made me laugh. Also, I can't explain the hold that Mrs. Lark could exert. Lyndon was sullen to her and insulting behind her back. Yet he'd do anything she said. He consented because she forced him, and after that, as you know, I became very ill.
Yes, said my father, I remember. You contracted a bacterial infection from the hospital and were sent to Fargo.
I contracted an infection of the spirit, said Linda precisely, in a correcting tone. I realized that I had made a terrible mistake. My real family came to my rescue, got me on my feet again, she went on. And Geraldine, too, of course. Also, Dolof Fernay put me through their sweat lodge. That ceremony was so powerful. Her voice was wistful and so hot. Rando gave me a feast. His aunts dressed me in a new ribbon dress they made. I started healing and felt even better when Mrs. Lark died. I suppose I shouldn't say that, but it's the truth. After his mother was gone, Lyndon moved back to South Dakota, and soon he cracked again, or so I heard.
Cracked, I asked. What do you mean by that?
He did things, said Linda.
What things, I asked.
Behind me, I could feel the force of my father's attention. Things he should have got caught for, she whispered, and closed her eyes.
Chapter 7, Angel 1. Although he was often to be found at the corner of the house sitting on a chipped yellow kitchen chair watching the road, this was not how Musham spent his day, but merely a pause to rest his stringy old arms and legs. Musham eagerly wearied himself with an endless round of habitual activities that changed with the seasons. In autumn, of course, there were leaves to rake. They came from everywhere to settle on Musham's patch of scrawny grass. He sometimes even plucked them off with his fingers and threw them in a barrel. It delighted him to burn them up. There was a short hiatus after the leaves and before the snow fell. During that time, Musham ate like a bear. His belly rounded and his cheeks puffed out. He was preparing for the great snows. He owned two shovels, a broad blue plastic rectangle that he used for fluffy snow, and a silver scoop with a sharp edge for snow that had packed or drifted. He also had an ice chipper, a hoe-like instrument with a blade that ran straight down instead of curving over. He sharpened this one with a file until it was so keen it could easily slice off a toe. Musham's battle array stood ready in the back entry through October. When the first snow fell, he put on his galoshes. Clements had glued sandpaper of the roughest grade to the bottoms. Every other night or so, she changed the paper and let the boots dry on the radiator. Musham's galoshes fit over his rabbit-furred trim moccasins and insulated socks. He wore work pants lined with red flannel and a puffy fluorescent orange parka that Clements had given him so that he could be found if he got lost in the snow. Moosehide mitts lined with rabbit fur and a brilliant blue stocking cap with a wild pink pom-pom concluded this outfit. He went out every single day in his flamboyant gear and labored with incremental ferocity. He was ant-like. He hardly seemed to be moving. Yeti shoveled trails to the garbage cans, cleared the snow not only from the walking paths around the house, but completely off the driveway, and